Jazz.
Malcolm Turnbull announced the laws of math do not apply here.
One of my favourite brands of comedy, Ariel, is brown people and black people making fun of white people.
Senators have been dropping like flies recently.
Shouting out the fact that in the Knowles-Carter family, women just have one name.
Backchat on FBI Radio.
Hello and welcome to Backchat, the freshest wrap of news and current affairs on the radio. I'm Ariel Bogle.
And I'm Osman Faruqi, and it's the first time we've been back together in the same room for like a month.
I know, now. It feels like ages.
We've been off doing other exciting things, and last week, if you tuned in, you would have heard awesome wrap of the National Young Writers Festival from Newcastle. Talked about pop culture and politics and all sorts of fun things, but it's good to be back with you, Ariel. Yeah. In the same physical location.
I know. It feels weird. I feel like there's the red light on. I don't know what to do. forgotten how to do radio, to be honest.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. Don't mess up the buttons. It's hard work. Look, today on the festival, today on the show on Backchat, we're going to be talking about something that is related to festivals. It's drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Festival season is around the corner. In fact, it might have officially kicked off. I don't know what the definitive like timeline is for when we can say festival season is here.
Yeah, I feel like the sideshows are starting to happen in like November.
It's like Melbourne Cup. Does that apply? Like the party season starts with Melbourne Cup. Does that include summer festival season?
For some, the party might start with Melbourne Cup. For the more discerning among us, it does not.
Yeah, Melbourne Cup's not my vibe, just to be clear. But anyway, festival season is basically here. We know what that means. That means drugs, it means drug dogs, and yeah, a little bit of music, you know, as well, if that's your kind of vibe. There's been a couple of episodes this week relating to Australia's drug laws and music festivals that we thought kind of interestingly juxtapose Australia's current approach to drugs and how that's impacting the welfare and safety of punters and drug consumers, basically. So last week, over the weekend, 11 punters in Newcastle were hospitalised after they took so-called blue Superman pills. These were pills that were sold as MDMA. They were little blue pills with a Superman S logo, hence the name Blue Superman, very original. They were sold as MDMA, but turns out they weren't. The hospital officials and medical officials have been testing them because it's quite a big mass overdose. They haven't figured out what was in the drugs, but they know for sure that it's not MDMA. And the police put out a statement and they said, "You never know what is in the pill you're about to take, what it may or may not contain. These pills are made by criminals in backyard labs and might be sold as one substance, but actually another." And, you know, there's actually a lot of truth in what the police have said. Whether or not the current approach to dealing with drugs is any kind of response to that reality is a different matter. It's kind of what we're going to expand on.
Yeah, so of course, for decades and decades, the police have been trying to quash drug taking at festivals. It has not worked. People continue to take them and they continue to have adverse reactions to drugs that are not what they appear to be. But there is a solution to this. It's called pill testing, of course. And I feel like for the past few years, the sort of discussion around pill testing has been building. This is the idea that you'd go to a festival, there might be a little tent there where you can give somebody your drugs. They'll test them, say what's in them, say whether they're safe to consume or not. And there was a festival, Spilled Milk, that was going to be one of the first in Australia to undertake this pill testing, but they have backed away from that now. The ACT government early announced that the Spilled Milk Festival would be the first in Australia to have pill testing. It's not quite clear why it was scrapped. There was a lack of documentation, apparently, but others have suggested it was under pressure from the federal government. And so it's just an interesting sort of moment to reflect just on the cusp of festival season, on whether it is possible to have safe, responsible drug taking in Australia or not.
Yeah, totally. And to me, it's so interesting that these two things happen in the same week, when that Newcastle mass overdose seems to just be such obvious evidence as to why pill testing facilities would help people. Like the police can say you shouldn't take illicit drugs. You know, they've been saying that forever. Politicians can say it as long as they want. It's not going to change what people do. People have always consumed drugs and they always will. And by not giving people the tools to find out whether they're consuming what they think it is, whether that's MDMA or anything else, you're basically just creating a situation where this stuff is going to become more common. And what I'm interested to see now is if there is, you know, a bad situation at Spilt Milk, whether someone ODs or if someone takes like a really bad drug and they get hurt, like what is the government's response going to be to that? Like, because there was an opportunity to improve safety and they've squibbed it. And so, to be honest, I think that they're responsible. I think the police and the government are responsible. If they're not, if they're if they're resisting measures to make things safer and people get hurt.
Sure. And we'd love to hear from you on this. If you have any thoughts about pill testing, whether pro or anti, it's 0409 945 945. And just to put my police shoes on for a second and imagine what their point of view is. I mean, people have said this. They might feel that allowing pill testing is a slippery slope towards drug legalization. So this is the idea that if you allow people to take illicit materials but give them a sort of way to, it's like a nod towards what they would think of as a free-for-all for drugs, I suppose, that pill testing would be the first step on the road to full legalization of narcotics and everything else like they have in Portugal, for example. So, I mean, I guess it depends on your opinion of whether drugs should remain illegal in Australia or not, and that's a bigger discussion.
Yeah, I think the other thing about how Australia approaches this stuff, and it's interesting to compare this to the US. I spent a few weeks there, went to a bunch of different music festivals, and in, you know, most states, all drugs are still criminalized. In a few states, you know, marijuana has become legalized for recreational purposes. But even in places like New York, where marijuana is still illegal and, you know, pills are certainly legal, the way that their police seems to be quite different. So you tend to not see heavy law enforcement and sniffer dogs, for example, at music festivals. And there's been a lot of, you know, activists and advocates groups like Unharm that say that kind of heavy policing at Australian festivals also makes things unsafe for festival goers, because they might freak out and take all the pills. Exactly.
Right.
So I wonder whether, like, even without changing laws or introducing things like pill testing, if the police and politicians were able to just realize that what they're doing is not stopping anyone. Like, they're saying the whole point of drug laws is to keep people safe. But if we've got drug laws and they're hurting people, like, even if their argument, as you laid out, Ariel, has merit, like, I personally don't agree with their argument, but even if you think it does, the premise of it doesn't seem to stack up to me.
Yeah, I find it interesting, having been to music festivals overseas in other countries, as you said, that police presence, the drug dogs, the sort of tension before you get into a festival doesn't so much exist in other countries, although by no means is America like an exemplary place for drug enforcement, because it disproportionately targets people of colour and minorities. Whereas in Australia, maybe we talk about it more because all the white kids going to festivals get freaked out by the dogs, you know?
Like, that's true. Maybe, like 90% of the sniffer dogs in Sydney tend to be at, like, Redfern Station on Friday and Saturday
exactly,
nights.
Exactly. So maybe our discussion is sort of being, detoured into pill testing when we should be talking about drug enforcement more generally.
Yeah, it's actually a really good point. Yeah, because pill testing, even if it's important, it does impact a subset of people going to music festivals. It tend to be from different backgrounds to the people that end up being locked up for, you know, like, low-level drug possession in this country. It's, yeah, good point.
Absolutely. So we've got a good show ahead of you. We're going to be getting into the debate about the influence of the Chinese Communist Party on Australian universities. You probably have seen the sort of big, scary headlines about this in the newspaper and on TV recently. There was a big Four Corners report about that too. But first, we have a track from RVG, A Quality of Mercy.
That was RVG with A Quality of Mercy, and you're listening to Backchat on FBI 94.5, streaming on fbiradio.com.
So you might have seen a bunch of stories lately about the role of Chinese students speaking out in Australian universities about material they think is offensive. So there was a story about an incident at the University of Newcastle where students complained to a lecturer that Taiwan was being characterised as a country. This is feeding into a sort of general anxiety about the influence of the Chinese Communist Party in Australia. And it came to a head this week when DFAT Secretary Francis Adamson told students at the University of Adelaide's Confucius Centre that, quote, silencing of anyone in our society, from students to lecturers to politicians, is an affront to our values. So is this something we genuinely need to be worrying about? Or is it just a little overblown? To discuss, we've got James Lorentzen from UTS. He's the Deputy Director of Australian-China Relations Institute, and he joins us now on the phone. Hi, James.
Good morning.
So, James, you know, I've just laid out some of those stories that are emerging in the media about altercations, I suppose, between students here from China and lecturers and course material and things like that. Why do you think this anxiety is blowing up now?
Look, I think Australia generally is dealing with the challenges of rising China. 20 years ago, China didn't have the world's largest economy. There weren't 130,000 Chinese students studying at Australian universities. Now China's, you know, front and centre in the world stage. And one of the areas we're seeing this, particularly in Australia, is in universities, because that's where we have all these students. You know, and that brings some challenges. Of course, it's also a wonderful opportunity as well. Certainly our universities don't mind the money they're contributing to the education system.
Absolutely not. And you've written a bit about this, and one thing you pointed out, which I thought was kind of valuable, was that the sum total of the incidents that have occurred this year have been around 4. Meanwhile, there are more than 100,000 Chinese students here in Australia. So, you know, what's that discrepancy? What's behind that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, why is there this media narrative of characterizing these 132,000 Chinese students as, you know, wildly patriotic, and one commentator referred to red-hot patriotism? Well, you know what? 4 incidents out of 132,000 students, I don't think you can describe that as red-hot patriotism. And look, to be honest, it's also in contrast to what the academic literature says as well. There's good evidence that says young Chinese these days are actually less nationalistic than older generations. So why is it different? I'm not quite sure, but I think it's got to do with this China threat narrative that we seem to be seeing more and more of.
So, James, even if, you know, I think a lot of people would agree with that point, that it's you know, it's silly and unfair to paint, you know, 130,000 students who come from different backgrounds studying different things all have their own experiences and views on issues and put them all together in one category. But despite that, there's 4 incidents, but we know from the stories that there have been a number of students that have attacked or criticized lecturers in those different situations, and it's more than just 4 students, for example. Is that like, are you sort of suggesting that we shouldn't pay attention at all, or do you think that this is something that's gone on and maybe it's social media that's made us a bit more aware of it? And I guess, sorry to kind of throw so many questions at you, but do you think that there's any kind of coordination going on, or these are all just sort of random incidents that are just popping up now?
I don't think there's any coordination going on, that's for sure. Fran Martin, who's an associate professor at the University of Melbourne, she's actually done a lot of comprehensive interviews with Chinese students. And amongst her cohort that she's been talking to, she reports that only 2 have had direct contact with the Chinese embassy in Australia. So I find it very, very difficult to believe that Chinese embassies are coordinating and inciting these students to speak out. Now, on the other hand, do we need to be concerned by it? Absolutely. You know, freedom of expression is a core value for Australian universities. What we need to be very careful, though, is that it is a core value that we support in all students. So, you know, quite frankly, I mean, I've been teaching in Australian universities for more than 20 years. I've had Chinese students come up to me and object to when I've referred to Taiwan, for example, as a country. But you know what? It's really not that hard to deal with. What they want is just for you to listen to their views, respect their opinions, and state your case. So I don't think we should be overreacting to these incidents.
So the institute where you work, the Australian-China Relations Institute, has also come in for some criticism this year about the source of its funding, being funded by Chinese entrepreneurs here in Australia, and its independence. You know, how have you personally responded to those criticisms? And do you think there is an idea that some of Australian universities are tied closely with China, not just in student population, but also in sources of funding for universities?
Yeah, look, this is a question, and look, the best way we can answer that is simply to lay out the facts. So for all your listeners, I just encourage them to jump onto ACRI's website and download our annual report. The reality is that 70% of our funding comes from the University of Technology Sydney. The other 30% comes from 20 corporates, and only 4 of them are Chinese, the rest of them Australian companies. So, you know, I think when presented with this data, you can get a pretty clear picture of where our funding's come from. And you know, you can draw from that whatever you want.
So, James, we're focusing on, in this discussion, the issue of students at universities and, you know, challenging the curriculum. But in the last couple of months, I guess in the last couple of years, there's been broader media reporting of the influence of, you know, Chinese government officials, potentially Communist Party figures, businessmen with links to both of those organizations. And particularly in the political sphere, there's been concerns raised that, you know, the amount of foreign donations coming through to our political parties from Chinese nationals is skewing the political agenda when it comes to foreign policy issues. Do you think that those kind of warnings are worth paying attention to? And what do you make of this broader context? It seems to be like in these different spheres, we're getting this narrative of China is influencing Australian politics, it's influencing Australian media, it's influencing Australian academics. Like is that really what's going on?
Yeah, look, so that's a big question. Look, on the issue of political donations, I wish Australia would just ban foreign political donations, right? That's not hard. I think everyone would support that. Again, I guess the issue for me, though, is that really the biggest problem that Australia's political system has? Ban them, go ahead. But the reality is, there was a good article on The Conversation recently that made the point that in the last federal election campaign, total foreign donations only accounted for 2.5% of total political donations.
Yeah, right.
So you ban it for sure, but then you've still got the 97% to worry about. And I'm sure in those donations there is a lot to worry about. So you know, this focus on foreign donations and China in particular, again, I think the danger is that we're just blowing it out of all proportion. But one other point you mentioned, it's a great point. I mean, 3 years ago we had concerns about the sale of the Port of Darwin to a Chinese company.
Yeah.
Then there were the political donations. Now it's Chinese students. Certainly I and a lot of my other Australia-China-watching colleagues are just wondering, what's next? You know, we need to just, there's nothing wrong with having the debate. Let's have it. But let's make sure it's based on facts. And certainly the case of Chinese students, 4 incidences with, 132,000 students, I don't think the facts square up to the rhetoric.
So, I mean, I think we can all accept that all countries try and build influence in other countries. I mean, America certainly does it, and the American Embassy here funds hundreds of events each year, study exchanges, Israel does too, and Australia does as well in other countries. So what? But how does China do it? I mean, just give us an idea of what China's priorities are when exerting influence in Australia and how they go about that.
You know, I think China's priorities are exactly what you would expect them to be. I mean, on things like territorial sovereignty, for example, they're not budging one inch. So they will strongly object to any characterization of Taiwan, for example, as an independent country. You can expect that they will remain firm on the South China Sea. Now, look, on all these issues, China can go ahead, right? But the question is how do we respond to them? We're actually in control of our response. So, for example, China can object to us, our position on the South China Sea, fine, we can hold the line. And that's exactly what the federal government has done, and I think they've done a very good job. So again, you know, Chinese can try to influence, but it's up to us whether we are influenced. And I just don't see a lot of evidence, in fact, that we are being influenced. This year, for example, the federal government has come out in very strong support of the US alliance, probably too strong, according to most Australians. So I'm just not seeing this evidence that we're being shifted towards China.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether you think that there might be cultural factors at play in terms of how much we talk about this issue, James. So you mentioned how the total foreign donations being made in this country is a small fraction of the rest of the donations, and we might focus on one Chinese businessman more than we focus on the amount that banks are giving, and obviously governments have close relationships to banks and policies they make benefit or don't benefit them as things may go. When we look at things like the housing market, there's headline after headline about Chinese nationals buying up property in Australia. When you look at the numbers, it's less than 0.1% of property.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is there a race element, I guess I'm asking? Is that something old school drilled into Australian psyches that they're being like manipulated over?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think, you know, when we're talking about is there racism involved, it's really hard to know for sure. Look, I just read a great book recently by the author Robert Macklin. And what he did, he's just published this new history of Australia-China relations over the last 200 years. And he traces the whole history, and there's certainly a lot of racism that's been a consistent feature of the Australia-China relationship. Look, I do think we're seeing some of that. But look, I don't mean to say that this is all made up, okay? There are genuine concerns around national security, for example, that we need to take seriously. But I just think it's not fact-based. You know, as long as we're sticking with the facts and making policies based on the facts, that's fine. But when we overreact, I think that's when you have to start asking questions, are factors like racism actually lurking just beneath the surface?
I was also curious too, because I went to ANU and I remember back in around 2010, 2011, there was a lot of furor in the press about the influence of the Iranian government at ANU, and there was some idea that there were students who were spies and spying on other Iranian students. We never have these conversations about the influence of, you know, American rhetoric in our universities, or Israeli rhetoric, or French rhetoric for that matter. I'm just wondering, Do you think, will China be the target of this for the ongoing next few years? Do you see this as a sort of cyclical process and the fear will sort of reassert back on, into the Middle East if things like blow up there again? It's that kind of cycle, maybe.
Yeah, unfortunately, I wish it was a cycle and we're about to get out of it. But the truth is, I think this is probably more structural. And I think China is going to stay the focus for a very long time. There's a couple reasons for that. One, I think, is coming from the United States. I think the United States is feeling very vulnerable now, that it is no longer clearly the world's number one dominant country. China's on the rise. And I think we see that in terms of the US putting some pressure on Australians, Australian politicians and opinion leaders. I'll give you one example. I had an article in the East Asia Forum, which is a blog post of the ANU this week. And one of the things I noted in that was the American government this year has been insistent that America is Australia's number one economic partner. Now, when you look at the data, it doesn't stack up. China is our number one economic partner. So why is America insisting that? Well, I think it feels vulnerable. It worries that Australia might shift to China. And so therefore, it's pretty keen to exert whatever influence it can to make sure that a country like Australia stays in the American camp.
James, thank you so much for joining us on Backchat. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this morning, but we really appreciate your thoughts and insights.
My pleasure.
That's James Lawrenson from the Australia-China Relations Institute, UTS, where he's the deputy director, talking about the influence of the Chinese government on Australian academia, as well as the broader issue of Chinese donations on Australian politics and the whole debate around a rising China, what that means for Australia.
So, of course, we have to get back into our regular segment. I feel like I've missed it. It's been a while.
I missed it a lot, man. I'm keen for it.
Of course,
kick it off.
This is Backchat Roulette. Back again. Oz, what did you see this week that shocked, surprised you, and that other people might not have noticed?
Well, dude, I saw it this morning, and I don't know if people are on this or they're sleeping on it, but Will Smith from Fresh Prince fame, as well as Men in Black fame.
Fresh Prince fame.
Rapping Will fame. Smith. Well, I've probably been in more recent films and shows since then. I don't know. That's when I tapped out. Anyway, he's dropped a new track. He's dropped an EDM track called Get Lit. It is not great, unfortunately. It sounds like a B-side or like a D-side on a Major Lazer record, but it's kind of fun. He's, you know, mixing up a little bit, but I kind of wanted just to bring him into the mix because I'm really standing his son, Jaden Smith, at the moment. He's become my style, culture, all sorts of thing icon. And weirdly, I was kind of looking up some facts about Chance the Rapper. Really like Chance the Rapper. He's doing some cool stuff. Chance obviously is very good friends and close collaborator with Kanye West, another hero of mine, another style icon, culture icon of mine. And Chance and Kanye have been working together for a couple of years, but they were actually introduced backstage at a concert, 2011, I think, something like that, by Jaden Smith.
Whoa.
Jaden Smith's the
guy
that...
He's the glue that holds
he's
together
the glue.
Our culture.
That's it. And when you look at Kanye's album and the tracks on it produced by Chance, like Waves, Father Stretch My Hands Part 1, and on Chance's album, it's like some of the best music, and we owe it to Jaden Smith. And I guess we owe him to Will and Jada Pinkett. So, yeah. So,
yeah, quick query.
Yeah.
What does Jaden do every day? Like, I know he's, like, got great clothes. He's, like, styling. He's, like, always at the right concert, he's at Fashion Week.
Yeah, that's what he's doing. He's doing it for the culture.
Okay. Yeah. But he's not a musician himself?
Don't throw shit. No, he's a musician himself.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's released some tracks. He was on the...
Because I know his sister has made some really good
Never Say Never with Justin Bieber off the Karate Kid album. Jaden Smith had a rap verse on that.
Because his sister actually had a really great R&B album, which I recommend everybody.
With My Hair? Was that her?
No. Yeah, that was her, but she's had an album since then, which is really actually
Smith
quite
kids,
a nice
they're onto it.
R&B album, so everyone should check that out.
I'm sure you've got a more important thing to talk about, though.
I do. Someone's going to bring down the tone a little bit and just reference the whole Harvey Weinstein shenanigans, awful stories that have been coming out this week. Of course, Harvey Weinstein was this big shot Hollywood producer, and now there's been story after story from the likes of like Angelina Jolie, Gwyneth Paltrow, and many more alleging cases of assault and rape even against this producer. He had such a modus operandi about inviting women to his hotel room, you know, vulnerable young women at the beginning of their career when they were worried that his sort of stamp of approval would either make or break them in Hollywood, basically. But I just wanted to shout out a piece from The New Yorker online. This is Gia Tolentino's How Men Like Harvey Weinstein Implicate Their Victims in Their Acts. And if you want to understand how you know, just being sexually harassed makes women feel, I really recommend this piece, because she really nails how women rationalize it to themselves. So she says, you know, if you're a gentle person, then he knew you were weak. If you were talented, he thought of you as an equal. If you're ambitious, you wanted it. If you're savvy, you knew it was coming. If you're affectionate, you seemed like you were asking for it all along. These are the ways that women, whatever their personality and type, sort of make the harassment feel like they caused it, that they are at fault in it. And so I really recommend it, just to get, as you know, a handle on this really horrible evolving story about Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's a great piece. Strongly recommend it. Thanks, Ariel. That's all we got time for. Got to thank our awesome behind-the-scenes production crew, Sam Johnsha, Amelia Zhao, and Linda Hong. Thanks for listening. Like I said at the top of the show, it's good to be back in the studio with Ariel. Coming up next on FBI is Agenda. Stick around.